This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Artificial intelligence is no longer a theory or a science fiction plot. It is all around us, and most of us use it every day.
Your car uses AI to manage the transmission. The routers in this building use AI.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about a new National Commission on Artificial Intelligence and how ethical questions about its use start and end with us, the humans. Then we'll talk to a filmmaker who, in her latest project, travels around the world listening to people's stories about climate change. And since we're talking about climate, how about an academic minute about the polar vortex? I'm Bob Barron, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Artificial intelligence sounds scary. Okay, maybe it does to me, and that's because I watch a lot of movies. If nothing else, it sounds futuristic. Now, a new commission authorized by the National Defense Authorization Act for 2019 has been named to study artificial intelligence, or AI. The independent federal commission is expected to review global advances, investments, and strategies in artificial intelligence and related technology systems. They'll evaluate foreign developments and investments in AI and recommend steps the U.S. might take to support its technological edge while ensuring national security and competitiveness. It's a lot going on there, and one of the members of that commission is Dr. Ken Ford. He's the founder and CEO of the Institute for Human and Machine Cognition. We sat down after the commission was announced and talked about the mission of the commission.
The purpose and mission of the commission is to take a forward look at AI and its societal implications. So much of our focus will connect to military applications of AI, but also the broader societal impacts of AI.
What are the areas of expertise of some of the other members of the group?
It's a very interesting group in that the backgrounds are quite dissimilar, and this could augur poorly or well, and I'm hoping it's the latter. There are three or four people like myself of the 15 that are academic AI researcher types. And I think there's nobody from a university, but there are people that certainly would qualify as academic researchers. And then there are four or five senior business leaders. And then the other four or five would be people with extensive experience in policy from a government perspective.
Looking at what you're being charged with, one of the topics was ethics. How do ethics come into this?
Well, people are concerned, sometimes motivated by science fiction, but people are concerned about machines run amok. And there are some legitimate ways that AI could be seriously misused. And so it's not so much the ethics of the machine, but the ethics of the people that deploy the machine. The technology is merely a tool for humans, and it has all to do with our wisdom with which we use these technologies.
So are you trying to make sure we don't get Skynet?
That's right. and quite a lot of other things. But the again, this discussion is often framed in terms of trying to endow the machine with an ethical framework, like Asimov's laws. We have a hard time endowing ourselves and our children with an ethical framework, and that's really what matters. It's sort of abdicating responsibility for what we do with the machines when we connect the ethics to the technology. The ethics really needs to reside in the humans and do things that are not harmful with these kinds of new technologies.
Is this mainly robotics, or does it go beyond that?
It's mostly not robotics. So we're surrounded by AI continuously. It's pervasive in our world. Every time you use the internet, you're engaging with AI systems. Facebook, Google are AI companies, essentially, and your car uses AI to manage the transmission. The routers in this building use AI. So it's all around us, and it's nothing to be feared innately, but it brings a suite of capabilities. And the idea is for this commission to think about this and to provide some guidelines.
You talked about the military being involved with this, military implications. Are we talking defense, offense, or will you know when you get in the room?
Well, the military is not directly involved in the commission or the study, but there are several people with military backgrounds, including myself, on the study, and the study was tasked explicitly to look at military considerations of the application of AI. For example, would you be comfortable having a machine make targeting decisions? Currently, that is prohibited in the Department of Defense in the United States, but not elsewhere. So that would be an example of a ethical consideration that would be something I'm sure the committee will discuss.
Well, it looks like you're pretty fast-tracked on this. Is it a 90 days they're expecting a report?
They're expecting a report 90 days from the start date, which was probably 89 days ago. The government shutdown delayed everything more than a month because the backlog is sort of a nonlinear function of the shutdown. But the initial report will be, sort of a placeholder, and the more profound reports will be forthcoming over time.
And how much time are you being given to do this?
Well, it's unclear, but we want to get it done quickly. We're hoping to be efficacious about this. One of the biggest challenges is aligning these people's schedules. You know, so you have folks like the founder of Google on this committee or commission and many other people with a lot of demands on their time. And so just getting together has proven to be very difficult.
Is this done in person or are you, you're Skyping it in?
We've had one remote meeting and we'll be meeting in person most of the time. The first one will be in the D.C. area, but we may decide, in fact, this is a topic for discussion at the first meeting, do we have meetings at various locations, and do we have any public engagement? But the reports will be public, and not any of it will from this group will be classified.
Dr. Ken Ford is the founder and CEO of the Institute for Human and Machine Cognition. That's located in Pensacola, Florida. Still to come, a filmmaker has a new project to help teach the world about climate change. We'll talk with her next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Dana Ruggiero is at heart an environmentalist. She started appearing on TV at age 19 to advocate for animals and promote conservation. Since then, she's been interviewed by news programs on most of the networks, coordinated with Animal Planet, TLC, and the Food Network for features, partnered with Discovery on a film tour of California's sustainable farmers, and collaborated with the Sierra Club on the Emmy Award-winning series Years of Living Dangerously. She also produced an international video series with the Environmental Paper Network. Her latest project is called the Climate Listening Project. I spoke with Dana and asked about the new project.
The Climate Listening Project is a film project that I started in 2014 to connect hopeful conversations on climate and community.
And who do you talk to during this?
I have traveled across the country and around the world to listen to individuals farmers, people who fish, parents, scientists, birders, and I try to follow the connections, the food that we eat, the things that we love, the children we care about, the faith that we believe in, and I connect those conversations not to try to convince anyone that climate change is real, but to share these hopeful stories and to show the real people that are impacted by climate change and the real people creating solutions.
And when you speak, what are the questions that you want answered from these people, or is it just kind of an organic conversation?
Oh, it's very much an organic conversation. It's kind of called the Climate Listening Project because I want to be able to go out and listen to these people's stories, allow them to be their whole selves. I'm not listening to environmentalists. I'm listening to everybody. And so it gives people an opportunity to share the climate impacts that they're seeing, or maybe the businesses that they've started, the solutions that they're creating, and give people an opportunity to share their stories. And then I share these stories with the hope that others will also listen and know that they're not alone.
When you have these conversations, do you sometimes walk away with more questions than answers?
Oh, you know, I definitely walk away sometimes with a heavy heart. And I know that when I finally create the films and I share those films, you know, it takes some of that weight off of my heart because these people are so inspiring to me and their stories are so powerful that, you know, it's just an opportunity to get them out there and be able to answer some of the questions that so many people have. You know, what are people experiencing? Am I the only one that's experiencing this? Are there solutions out there? And these stories really give people an opportunity to see somebody like them on the screen. You know, I've interviewed so many people in the last 5 years, hundreds of people, and there's almost an opportunity to see somebody just like you in one of these films. And so I think it provides a lot of connection for people. It definitely answers my questions, but there's always more questions to ask.
Have you spoken to someone while you were doing this and could actually point to, yes, here's how my life changed because of climate change?
Absolutely. You know, when I started this project, I was coming off of a year, 2013, I'm living in North Carolina now. It was the rainiest year ever in the history of North Carolina. That has now been surpassed by 2018, was the rainiest, wettest year ever in North Carolina. And that was due to Hurricane Florence, a lot of rain in a very short period of time. I just recently was traveling around Florida, and I got a chance to go back to where I studied at UWF, and I worked for the local wildlife refuge and the zoo and the newspapers. And I went to visit Mexico Beach and saw the damage and the impacts there from the hurricane. And, you know, when I returned from my last tour, traveling across America, listening to women who are fighting back against the impacts from climate change, I had to evacuate my home because of a 100-year drought and forest fires like we had never seen before. You know, I think that the impacts that I'm seeing, you know, out west when I traveled to Montana and the, you know, depleted forest due to the pine beetle, you know, there's always something that I'm seeing when I'm on the road, and then there's stories that I'm listening to that basically connect the dots of, you know, there's a bird that I followed from North Carolina to Belize, a migratory bird that, you know, by knowing where this bird travels to now, people in North Carolina and Belize and people across the whole East Coast that love this songbird, the wood thrush, they know, okay, now we know what areas we need to protect because we know exactly where it's migrating to. But now because of climate change and the research and the scientists and the good work that's being done, we know where they might travel to in the future and what areas we need to protect there as well. And so I think that, you know, listening to these stories, it gives us an opportunity to know, all right, this Miami community is flooding every year more and more. Well, people can't get to work. What does this mean for local businesses? What does this mean for the tourism industry? I think that there's so many interconnected pieces of where we travel to, where we live, the places we love, the people that we love, that you're seeing these interconnected conversations happening. It's really bringing that into the light of these real stories.
There are so many different mediums today to get word out. Why'd you choose film?
You know, I choose film because it really gives people an opportunity to see those people like them on the screen, talking from farmer to farmer, faith leader to faith leader, parent to parent. And instead of, you know, just me getting up there and talking about what I've listened to, it really gives them an opportunity to be a part of the listening.
How do people get to see your films?
People can watch my films for free online on climatelisteningproject.org. Some of the films have been made into school curriculums that are shown at elementary schools. The films were shown at the Paris Climate Talks. They've been shown at events across the country. I've been lucky to win awards at film festivals. But all of the films are available for free without a paywall online. And also, people can use these films. They can show these films in their communities to help start or accelerate climate conversations.
You speak a lot to students. What do students want to know from you?
Oh, gosh. You know, so there's two things. One is, how do you feel comfortable listening to somebody's story? How do you go about listening? And when I started this, I thought that I would have some kind of set list of questions that I would ask in all of my interviews, trying to gather a data set. But that has not been the case, and I have totally thrown that away. And I really go in and listen and try to just be that full listening experience for these individuals to be able to share their stories comfortably. And every question that I asked is based on their previous answer. So it's really an organic conversation. And so students are really interested in that. And then the other piece is how to weave the science and the stories. So that is one thing that I really try to do with the Climate Listening Project. Through the Climate Listening Project, I'm not only focusing on our changing climate, but how we are changing as individuals, listening to our own realities, overcoming our fears, healing ourselves, and allowing ourselves to be our whole selves, because real change is not just about acknowledging and adapting to our changing climate, it's about changing our political climate, social climate, inclusion climate, economic climate. And so the scientists that are able to provide this hard data is really something that is weaved into the personal experiences of all of us, and also how we're interacting, the experiences that we're having individually with our own world. So each person is having such a unique experience in this time, but it's so important for all of us to come together. So how to weave that science into each personal experience for people to be able to understand and be able to share their full experiences and connect those experiences.
Outside of students, do you speak to community groups? Are there business leaders who are receptive to this?
Absolutely. Business leaders are very receptive to this. I speak to a variety of different types of businesses. So when I think of businesses, you know, I recently made a film about green building, and this was architects, real estate agents, all of kinds of people that are involved in the building world, and they're trying to think about how climate change is impacting the places where they're building, how do we build smarter. So there's so many different sectors, down to farmers. You know, there's a community in Georgia that I listen to where this farmer made the switch from conventional sort of extractive farming to sustainable farming. And not only did he see the impacts benefit his soil and his land and his farming, but he brought 150 employees back to work on the farm, which revitalized the whole entire community. So the businesses are, you know, from climate data innovators at a place called the Collider that are coming together with innovative solutions, apps, every kind of thing that you could possibly imagine to clean energy. I mean, we are seeing so much opportunity in creating climate solutions. We are innovators. Human beings are amazing, and we have the potential to really make an impact and also to do it in a smart way through our business. And so there's so many different sectors of business that are interested in climate solutions.
I imagine, though, you still have a way to go before you get Exxon on board.
Well, I've had an opportunity to work with a lot of different large companies through the years. So since I graduated from the University of West Florida, I have gone on to work with a lot of large companies like GM, Chevy Volt. They launched my first film tour. I went around in a Chevy Volt filming farmers across California who are doing sustainable work. I've worked with a lot of large companies that are interested in how do we do better. There's a climate expo that I speak at every year at the Collider. And that is bringing huge corporations like HP and IBM. You know, there's so many companies because climate change is a risk. Climate change is always a risk. And so how do we adapt to that risk? How do we create solutions for the risk? So businesses are definitely very interested in learning about solutions to climate change and how do we do better and how do we invest in those solutions?
I wonder if you could talk some about your work with the Environmental Paper Network. What is that?
Oh, I love the Environmental Paper Network. I recently launched a photo series with 15 people around the world from Mozambique, Scotland, Paraguay, Bolivia, England, Tasmania, Canada, the list goes on, and to listen to what inspires them, what their hopes are for the forest. And the Environmental Paper Network is a really collaborative, solutions-oriented group that is creating solutions for the forest pulp and paper industry. Paper is a big part of so many people's lives. It's a big connector. It's a big conversation that needs to be had, and they're creating those solutions. So those photos have been shared online, and they will be shared via National Geographic.
Dana Ruggiero's latest project is called the Climate Listening Project. You can learn more and hear some of those stories at danaruggiero.com. So since we're talking about climate, here's the thing. It's cold. That's all. It's just cold. Let's all blame the polar vortex. We can, you know, because it's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
It's time again for the polar vortex to invade the U.S. and the news. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Andrea Lang, assistant professor of atmospheric and environmental sciences at the University at Albany, explores what the polar vortex is and why it keeps making us bundle up during the winter months.
The polar vortex barrels across the U.S., and the polar vortex hits the Northeast were prominent headlines from December 2013. Images of commuters bundled in layers avoiding all-time record low temperatures and reporters battling the elements filled the news cycles. These news stories left many wondering, what is the polar vortex? The polar vortex is not a newly discovered phenomena. Every winter, as the polar region cools in the long dark nights, a polar vortex forms in the northern hemisphere. As this very cold air mass develops over the pole, a jet stream of strong eastward-blowing winds forms on the flank of that cold air in a layer from about 5 to 40 kilometers, 3 to 25 miles, above Earth's surface. In general, this combination of cold air and jet stream define the polar vortex. A polar vortex also develops every year during the winter months in the southern hemisphere, and polar vortex-like phenomena have been observed on other planets, including Saturn and Mars. From a scientific perspective, a polar vortex is a dynamically robust feature that has several components. One well above Earth's surface in the stratosphere, and another that is directly associated with the newsworthy cold air outbreaks located in the region known as the troposphere. In an average northern hemisphere winter, the polar vortex generally stays centered over the Arctic. Occasionally, a series of weather events can lead to a change in the large-scale atmospheric circulation that can disrupt the general eastward flow of the high-latitude atmosphere, nudging the polar vortex out of the Arctic towards more temperate latitudes. In these cases, warm air from the south moves into the Arctic, and cold polar vortex air from the Arctic moves south, creating a situation where extreme temperatures are likely to occur.
That was Andrea Lang of the University at Albany. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.